everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. I'm really looking forward to this. I have with me Dilip Barman, and I've known him for decades. I want to say that the time must be right, because when I started this podcast in 2009, I was looking for people to talk to. And Dilip Barman was one of the first people I reached out to, and he was busy, had a big busy teaching schedule. And I have to admit, I forgot to get back. And here we are, it's 2021, 12 years later, and I finally got Dilip on the show.
I'm honored.
So thank you for finding a moment.
Never too busy for you, Karen.
Thank you. Well, you were back then. You had, what were you teaching back then anyway?
I've been teaching for many years. So yeah. I was teaching probably plant-based eating. And I also teach, I used to be a professional photographer and I still teach photography. I teach math. I didn't teach math back then. I did, but not in a big scale. Now I teach a lot of math.
Okay. I love math. I was a mathlete in high school.
Wonderful. Excellent. I'm glad you know the term. A lot of people don't know that term.
Yeah. Well, we have a lot to talk about after we do this podcast. Anyway, Dilip has a nice resume, and I will have it posted along with this interview on the interview page. It's too long to read here, but let's just say you've been eating vegetables for a long time and promoting healthy living for a long time. Can you just give me a brief summary of how you became a vegan and why?
It's a great question. So to answer that fully, I have to talk a little bit about my background. So my parents were immigrants from India. And when they came from India, we all know people from the subcontinent now, but back then they were pioneers. You know, they came in the 60s, early 60s. And at that time, believe it or not, there were literally about 1,000 people from India in the whole country.
Wow.
Next to nothing. And so they were pioneers. And so, you know, they were lifelong vegetarians, not vegans, and their ancestors had been for a long time. And so I never asked them. I was born in the States and they brought me up eating meat occasionally. I'd go out, you know, to Dogs and Suds was this place in small town Ohio, or McDonald's or White Castle. And, you know, just like from the Jewish perspective, there's also a cleanliness issue. It's true in Hinduism too. And my parents were followers of Hinduism. So even though I would occasionally eat meat, it was ritually unclean. We would spread newspapers on the floor, and then I'd wash my lips and my hands with soap. And ideally, the meat eating would be done outside of the house. And I never asked. My thought is they probably said, what's this little boy going to do when he grows up? Most men don't cook, or at least that's probably what they thought. And he's in a land of meat eaters. So Karen, I grew up mostly vegetarian, eating a little bit of meat. My first year of college, I ate a lot of meat because, you know, I didn't eat that much of it at home, and it was kind of a treat. This is a food that I wasn't used to. Sure. So I ate lots of meat my first year in college. And then I became a vegetarian my second year, because that's the first time I had to shop for myself. And I went to the grocery store, and I had enough of a ethical, spiritual background through my family. And of course, health, I knew you didn't need to eat meat. And so I go to the grocery store the first time and stock up, and this is a dead animal. When you look at it, this is a dead animal. And I felt guilty. I felt bad. And I knew I didn't have to do that to survive. So I became a vegetarian, and I had no clue about veganism, you know, in college, no clue whatsoever. And I thought I was doing the right thing. In graduate school at Brown, one of the secretaries, Ginny was her name. Ginny invited me to a vegan Thanksgiving, and I had never heard of veganism. And
wow.
I went. Yeah. And there was a Rhode Island vegetarian activist group or something. And I took home literature and I read it, and it all made sense. It didn't make me a vegan. And I moved to North Carolina, started helping this group, Triangle Vegetarian Society. Eventually I ran the group, and I understood then what veganism meant, but I wasn't vegan. But to be honest, I'd give lots of talks and I'd say, this is ideal. It's the best for health, for ethics, environment. I'm not vegan is what I would say back then, but you should be vegan, or you should consider being vegan. And my palate, I like my cheese and so forth. So, but over time I was eating less and less of it. And so finally, about 20 years ago, I said, hey, I am a vegan. And I was a vegan. And I have been consistently since then. And I would never dream of going back.
Hooray. Thank you. Well, sure. You are a good poster person for veganism. I know that you've done a lot of work promoting this lifestyle and this way of eating. I'm just curious, you're in North Carolina. North Carolina is a really interesting place when it comes to food.
It's changing quickly.
There's a big vegan movement there.
Yes.
But at the same time, you have all that pork, all those pigs, those hidden pigs being grown and slaughtered.
Yeah.
And the lagoons that are polluting the waterways. How do you work with all of that?
It was a culture shock when I came down. I had no idea. I was telling my daughter about this and she was shocked. My daughter is, she's 12 years old. She's a lifelong, pre-lifelong, because my wife was a vegan when kiddo was in her tummy. So my daughter knows nothing but veganism. And even if she had a choice, she's convinced of the ethics of it. She tells us, as a 12-year-old, because my wife sometimes asks, she says, when you grow up, you can make your own choices. And she says, Mommy, that's something I would never choose. Why would I? I'm surprised my wife would ask her that. But I think my daughter is pretty committed. I view her as a stronger vegan than I am.
Sure.
A very quick example. We were on it, and I know I'm not answering your question. On a trip to California, and Sangeeta, my wife's cousins, were hosting us, and so we were staying at their place. And they were working, so they said, when you wake up, there's breakfast food available. And they did a great job. They're vegetarian, but they're not vegan, and so the bread had some honey in it. And so, from my perspective, ethically, I don't have a problem either way. I chose not to have the bread, but I'm glad my wife did, because it would look a little, holier than thou. Mm-hmm. I'm glad that some of the bread was eaten, and we never said that I didn't eat it. So that kind of exception to me is acceptable. I mean, to be honest, if she didn't make the exception, I probably would have, just to make sure our host didn't feel bad. I don't go further than that. I would not make an exception for eggs or fish or, dairy, but, we don't eat honey. I haven't bought it. I haven't eaten any honey since I was vegan. But I did make another exception, and that was, we had a pizza place that would donate vegan pizza for us for New Year's Eve. And they made a special batch, because their dough had a little bit of honey. They made a special batch just for us. So one busy New Year's Eve, they forgot. I had a 2-year-old or 3-year-old at the time, and we went to pick up the pizza, and they said, we goofed. There's no, vegan. I mean, it's all vegan otherwise, but there's a teeny bit of honey. And so I announced to the hungry folks who were waiting, we all congregated to this party, and I said, I have to be honest, this isn't 100% vegan. There's a little bit of honey, and everybody made that exception. I made the exception. I had a 2-year-old who had to eat. If it had dairy cheese, we would have run out. We would have gone home. We would have done something, but we had the honey. Anyhow, that's more than you wanted to know. But getting back to North Carolina, it was a culture shock, because when I was new here, I learned about pig pickings. I worked for IBM then, and we had a party, and they had this whole pig, and they were roasting it, and people were taking pieces out. And it was, I don't want to use very negative words, I don't want to offend people, but I felt certainly out of place. It smelled terrible, and it made me want to cry seeing this whole pig being killed.
Wow.
And being, for people's, just milling about and kind of, oh, I'll have a little bit more. It was just so, I've read Carolyn Adams, and I was thinking of some of her thoughts about, about objectification of bodies and so forth. So in terms of your question about North Carolina, I'm glad I'm here, because just practically, I grew up in Connecticut. It's so much cheaper living here, right? it's so affordable. And to be honest, there's so much to do. There's so much culture. There's a lot of people it's a melting pot of places, people from all over the place. And the food scene is great. There's lots of great vegan food. Yeah, if you want to look for, animal food, there's plenty of that too. We don't go there.
Yeah.
So I think it's good, because it also gives me it's a place where I can help influence other people and share that you don't need to eat those foods. And in fact, if you don't eat those foods, then, you'll probably, your health will turn for the better. And, you're doing the best thing you can possibly do for the environment, and certainly, for the animals. Later in our conversation, if you want me to, I can talk about being a food for life instructor for Physicians Committee. And so our focus there is health, and I can use that to share with people.
Definitely.
So I like living here.
Okay, that's good. My biggest concern, next to caring for the animals that are being raised and killed in North Carolina, is the environment. Because there's been a lot of bad things that have happened to the waterways, and I'm concerned about the lagoons and them leaking.
Oh, I am too, absolutely. And I think being here, I'm making an impact. I bet you my being here has very slightly mitigated that. I'd like to think that. Maybe I'm being a little self-important there, but I think that I've made some impact.
Absolutely.
Positive impact.
Okay. So let's talk about food for life, being a food for life instructor, what that is, and then we'll lead to what I really want to talk about, which is your so many cooks in the kitchen and so many kids in the kitchen.
And they're related. So I just feel such an honor that I'm part of, that I play a role in positions committee. They chose me to be a Food for Life instructor. We applied, it was my wife's suggestion. And I guess I've been an instructor since 2012 or something like that. Mm. And so Food for Life is a nutrition education program of Physicians Committee. Physicians Committee is this amazing group that Neil Barnard put together 15, 20 years, maybe longer ago. He's a powerhouse and just unbelievable the impact he has made, his organization, and the way everything PCRM does is so well done, so professionally run. The information is outstanding, relies on evidence, and it's just so impactful. And the fact that they'd have me is just wonderful. I'm just so honored. And so what I do as a Food for Life instructor is I teach all these classes that, you know, headquarters has developed, and we have classes. We purely focus on health. We don't talk about, you know, and I'm with you with environment and ethics, mm-hmm. but in Food for Life, we don't talk about those things unless it comes up in classes. We base it on evidence, right? So the evidence shows that if you go plant-based, you're going to stay healthy. If you're pre-diabetic or diabetic, there's a good chance you'll be able to control it. You might be able to reduce your medications. You might be able to reverse it. If you have blood pressure issues, if you have certain forms of cancer, you know, in terms of COVID-19, being vegan, whole food, plant-based, and our program isn't a vegan program, it's a whole food, plant-based program, which goes further. So we want to encourage people to eat food in as close a manner as it was grown. We want you to limit your fats. We want to aim for about 10% fat calories. So it's, you know, it's not vegan, it's beyond vegan. You can be an unhealthy vegan. You can be an ethical vegan and eat French fries and drink beer and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, if you eat French fries once in a while, that's fine, but you want to watch your overall fat content and be as whole food plant-based as possible.
When you use the phrase whole food plant-based, you are excluding animal products.
Yeah. And that's a troublesome word because there are different meanings for it in our classes, in my classes anyhow, and maybe at some point, you know, headquarters, I take direction from Physicians Committee for my classes. So far we're using the word whole food plant-based and I think it's been co-opted by others.
Absolutely.
I think people know that you got, even meat eaters will say, you know, I bet you even Weston Price, I can't say this for sure, I haven't looked into Weston Price in a while, but I think even meat eaters will say, of course you want to eat your fruits and vegetables, or at least your vegetables, but you know, there's a place for them, and you probably want to eat more than you're eating now. But you know, we're of course advocating eating from our power plate, you know, fruits, legumes, vegetables, and whole grains. To me, whole food plant-based means that you're eating plants in as whole of manner as possible. And I guess the ambiguity is based. You know, am I occasionally eating some dead fish or dead cow or dead pig or something like that? So maybe some people would call themselves plant-based. And so there is ambiguity. And maybe we need another word. The right word probably isn't vegan. Vegan has political connotations. I'm comfortable as a vegan, but some people will say, no, I don't want to be a vegan because that means that I have to march in the streets and be an animal rights activist. I'm also an animal rights advocate. I don't march in the streets as much as I used to. I do sometimes. But I think sometimes when you say vegan, it pushes people away, right?
Yeah.
So I want to bring people in. And Karen, I am 100% plant-based, but when I work with people, if I move them towards plant-based, if they were 20% plant-based, and with me, they're now becoming 40, 50, 60, that's success. Mm-hmm. Do I want them to be 100%? I do. But if they're moving, I'm not an absolutist, you know,
sure.
To me, it's success if they're moving. And, you know, I have students, you know, in my classes who say, Dilip, I've been following what you say and I slipped occasionally. So I had a student recently who went up to Maine and they had a family get together and they were eating dead lobsters, and it had a feeling for them as a child. She used to eat dead lobsters and everybody else was eating dead lobsters. So she did. And I don't pry. I don't ask, you know, I present my material. but I give my students an opportunity to share. And so she did. She said, Dilip, I have to tell you that I've been in your class at this point, it was 3, 4, 5 weeks, whatever. And I've been feeling so good for it. And I totally believe all this evidence, it's manifested in my life, the way I live. But on this trip, I did eat some crabs and or lobsters, whatever it was that they ate. And my response was, you know, I'm glad you recognize that. And, you know, what is the trend? Where are you moving? And she said, I'd like to be 100%. And I said, there you go. And thank you for your honesty. And the honesty is really with yourself, not with me. It doesn't matter that you told me that. I'm, you know, if you choose to share it with me, I'm happy to give you some feedback. And so I think if you're 100% vegan and somebody says that story and you say, what, you can't be, I can't work with you, you don't get it, forget about it, that causes more harm than good. And so I think the word vegan may not be the right choice here. I know there's good people who very much would disagree with me, and that's fine. But I do think plant-based, whole food plant-based is kind of what I like to share in my classes.
What about just whole food plant diet?
I never thought of that, Karen.
Yeah,
I should hang out with you more.
Thank you. I use that whole food plant diet because plant-based leaves room
absolutely
for other things. Yeah,
vegan whole food plant diet. Vegan after five or whatever that book is, right?
Oh, yeah, after six, Mark Fitton. Right. Yeah, why isn't he vegan? He knows it all.
And I've heard him speak.
Yep. Anyway. Yeah.
No, that's a good, you know, I'm gonna share that with other Food for Life instructors. That's
whole
a good,
food plant good, diet. Okay.
Whole food plant diet, right?
I want credit.
I'll give it
to
you.
No, I don't care.
But you know, there are really good people, and maybe I haven't looked recently what Michael's been saying, but Michael Greger, I think he says whole food plant based.
Well, I think did Colin Campbell coin that phrase whole food plant based?
I don't know.
I think he might have. Anyway. What's in a word? What's in a name? Now tell me, this Food for Life course, how long does it last? Can anybody take it? Does it cost something? How do people find out about it?
So the Food for Life program is we're licensed from headquarters from DC, Washington, DC. And so I have the license, and that means there's about 300 of us around the world. We're in probably all the states, I think, at this point. We're in Canada, England. We have instructors in Australia, in Hungary, in Brazil. So, you know, number of countries, Abu Dhabi.
Wow.
India, we have some partners in India. So being licensed means we can use the curricula. And the curricula, we have a whole bunch of classes. So the first class was our cancer class. It was called the Cancer Project. And the way the classes work is, on one hand, you can find great people like Neil Barnard or Colin Campbell or Caldwell Esselstyn or any number of people. Brenda Davis, one of my favorite nutritionists.
Yes.
So many people who will advocate veganism, whole food plant diet, as my friend Karen Hart class would say. But it's one thing to say, okay, my mind understands it, and I've even convinced my doctor, my nutritionist, so forth.
Nice.
What do I do in the kitchen? And that's where we come in. So we have classes, and we show a video of, many of the videos are of Neil Barnard. Neil's a superstar. He's the one who founded Physicians Committee. And in our most recent iteration, we actually have videos of some other very good people too, like Caroline Trapp, who's one of our diabetes educators, and some of the physicians at Barnard Medical Center. So we have additional voices. But anyhow, in the classes, we go around, how's the week been? How have you been doing? We generally meet once a week. And then I run my classes as a couple hours. They're designed to be about an hour and a half, but I take longer because I like to have our classes more leisurely. How's it been? How's the week been? And we encourage people to, at least for 3 weeks, to follow a low-fat, whole food plant diet. We call it a whole food plant-based diet. And we hear people's stories. And then what we do is we show a video, a nutrition video that goes into the nitty-gritty of a lot of disease processes and health processes. And then we give them a quiz. And then we go into the kitchen, and then the instructor cooks, and we usually make three different things. They get to eat. The food is designed by professional chefs. It's tasty. It's very healthy. And it's very easy to make. And then they go home with recipes and ready to come back the next week. So in terms of the number of sessions, it's totally up to us as instructors. I've done one-offs, although I don't like to do that. I prefer to do 5 to 7 week classes. So there's some continuity. We can meet each week. Some people do intensives, like for a weekend. I tried that. I didn't get enough people to sign up, so I didn't run that. And then we also have classes for kids. I'm the nutrition education director of a local elementary and middle school. And so I break up the classes to classroom time periods. So we have a classroom component, and then we work in the kitchen. And with the kids actually do the cooking, which is really fun. So that's a little bit about Food for Life. And as I said, I'm just one of about 300, and I'm really humbled that I'm part of this community, because everybody else in the community, all the instructors, just have so much knowledge, so much information, and I'm in touch with them on a daily basis, you know, sharing knowledge and information and ideas.
Okay, so if people can do one of two things. They can take a Food for Life course, but they could also learn to be an instructor, right?
Yeah. And so I recommend on your podcast, if you can share the website, it's fflclasses.org, foodforlifeclasses.org. And that's where you can look up who's teaching, where you can take it. And because of the pandemic, a lot of our classes have gone online. So if you want to take a class, for example, I teamed up with a fellow instructor in New York State in Long Island, and she and I taught signed up to teach a class together. So you can take virtual classes, and even if there's not an instructor in your vicinity who's teaching. But you were asking about becoming an instructor. It's pretty competitive to become an instructor. And we haven't had any training for over a year because of the pandemic. And headquarters just announced a couple of weeks ago that we are having our next training. And I don't remember the details, and I don't want to mention them in case I make any mistakes. But the next training, I think, is going to be virtual. And the dates have been set. And the process, Karen, for people to become a Food for Life instructor is the prerequisites. You've got to be vegan, right? You don't have to be limited fat. When I became an instructor, I used to use oil, and I wasn't as knowledgeable. I learned that in my training. But you have to be vegan. And if you ever decide not to be vegan, you immediately are no longer a Food for Life instructor. That's a hard and fast rule. I mean, how can you not be vegan? Like, when I was leading my vegetarian society, I could do it. I could say, okay, veganism is good. I'm not vegan. At that point, I wasn't vegan, but it's a thing. But I can't be an instructor and say, I believe in it, and it's good for your health, it's good for everything, and don't notice what I'm eating. I'm eating, you know, some Swiss cheese on the side. That would be the extreme hypocrisy, and it would totally take away. I mean, I believe in it. If nothing else, clearly for the health message I'm teaching in my classes, but for me also ethics and environment, right? And so to be a Food for Life instructor, you've got to be a vegan, and you have to have some experience teaching, and you have to submit some videos of your teaching vegan cooking classes. You have to have some letters of reference. You have to have an interview. And if all of that goes well, you'll be invited to come to DC, or now virtually for at least the next training. Mm. And it's a great training. They take us through a couple days, and you know, we're all very knowledgeable on food, but we become even more knowledgeable by the training. And we have ongoing training. Almost every month we have a call, and we learn about nutrition topics, administrative topics, ways, funding ideas, ways to reach out to, other organizations. It's wonderful. I always look forward to, we had our most recent PE professional or PD professional development was about how to be sensitive to different cultural norms. So if you're working with students, patients, if you're a doctor and they are of a different religion than yours, and understanding what food means to them, or if you have somebody who has a different ethnicity or different socioeconomic background, how to be sensitive to that and making recommendations. You don't want to, and I learned this from the school that I teach at, because we do have a significant number of people who are low income, and there's this perception that to be vegan, to be whole food plant-based, I have to shop at expensive stores, and I do shop at some expensive stores, but even if you shop there, you don't have to spend money if you're buying unprocessed food, non-processed foods. But some of these people at the school I teach at, they shop at gas stations, and we have to be aware of this. Yeah, honestly. And some of them are on, it's not called food stamps anymore. What's it called? It's called
SNAP.
Yeah, SNAP program. And so, I mean, if we had 2 hours, I could talk a lot about SNAP, but I won't. So I love the training. I'm just so thankful that they include me as one of the instructors.
Okay. Now, you have to be vegan, and I love that, to be a Food for Life instructor, but there is a range of vegan diets that one can have. And there's a debate between some of the, I'm doing air quotes, experts that say low fat is better, or you shouldn't be eating nuts
seeds. Nuts is very controversial.
Very controversial. So oil. I think most people agree that oil isn't good. Well, but there are some.
No. There's a lot of people have the perception, but olive oil is good for your health. And, you know, I could spend 5 minutes talking about that one. And that's common. That's very common.
So I want you to talk about it. But before I do, if you're a Fit for Life, if you're a Food for Life instructor.
Fit for Life is another program. That's a juicing program, I believe.
Yeah. And it's a book that came out a really long time ago.
From a guy in Florida, as I recall, right?
Right. I think he was part of the natural hygiene thing. Yeah. Okay. So if you're a Food for Life instructor and you're vegan and you've learned everything, but you kind of go off on your own a little bit, like maybe you're not saying 10% fat, you're saying you could have a little more of this a no-no?
It's a no-no. We have guidelines. So we're not required in our personal life to, you know, stick to the 10% fat calorie. I think most people do. Some people are more careful than others. You know, I have a young daughter, and we occasionally have, of course, vegan macaroni and cheese. We have Mayoko's cheese and all. So are those the best foods for what we're recommending? No. But I tell my own students that, you know, we have a wonderful ice cream place downtown, and about a third of the flavors are vegan. And I think I talk about this place too much because I really like it, but we don't go there that often, as it turns out. We go there 5 times a year. And so what I tell my students is be vegan, be 100% vegan. But if you occasionally go beyond the 10%, and I do, when I go out to restaurants, if it's easy, I'll say, can you cut back on the oil? But I like good vegan restaurants. And if they're using oil and if it's higher in fat, I don't go there that often. I'll enjoy it. And so the deal is, as long as your overall average is 10%, you're good. So you go out, you go on a cruise, and you're having high fat for a week, and then for a week or two, you're lower. You know, that is probably going to be okay. Ultimately, you have to decide what's right for you, and you should really. We don't want people to make, dietary changes without talking to their healthcare providers. We're giving information. We're sharing, you know, general ideas that. You know, by and large, if you cut back your dairy, if you go to zero dairy, zero meat, you're probably going to see these things, but talk to your healthcare provider. And so to answer your question.
Hopefully you can find a healthcare provider that knows something veg docs, about nutrition.
Right. And we talk about that in the classes too, that a lot of doctors are very well-intentioned, but many of them don't have the nutrition background. The average doctor spends something like 4 to 5, 6 hours of nutrition training, and they're all their 6 to 10 plus years of medical training. But yeah, as a Food for Life instructor, we do give the advice of limited fat. And I think most of us follow that. Among instructors, we have different views on nuts. And right now, the official policy is nuts is kind of on the side, and it's a small quantity. But there is a lot of evidence from really good people, Brenda Davis. What's the guy's name in Florida? He's Jeff Novick and others that Colin Campbell. And my guess, this is totally off the record. I do not represent Physicians Committee when I'm saying these things, but this is totally off the record. I suspect that at some point, all of us who are talking about nuts, Bob Leroy is a great guy. I don't know if you know Bob. Bob has some excellent ideas about nuts. So the more or less quasi-official idea, I think, is that if you're healthy, if you're at a good weight, and you happen to like the flavor of nuts, then a small handful a day of walnuts, for example, with linoleic acid and omega-3s, may be okay. But my intuition, based on all that I've read, is a little bit of nuts like walnuts. And Brazil nuts, Brenda is a big advocate for, because Brazil nuts are one of the few sources of selenium, which is good for a number of things, including brain health. Mm-hmm. And so Brenda's suggestion is have, you know, 2 or 3 small, medium-sized Brazil nuts, 3, 4, 5 times a week. It's worth the fat in the Brazil nuts. Mm-hmm. So I think these things will evolve. And I think the interesting thing from an evidence base, going beyond Physicians Committee, going to, you know, many, many other people who advocate plant-based eating, is there's so much good evidence, and it all converges on plants, eat plants. Where the difference is how much fat. We do suggest 10% fat calories. There are good people out there who go a little higher, 12, 15%. Why 10%? By the way, the reason 10% is every single study that's been shown to reverse any kind of health condition, like diabetes or different kinds of cancer, the reversal goes away at 10%. And if that's the case, then why not just aim for 10%?
Interesting. Okay. So now tell me about olive oil.
So there's this misnomer that olive oil is good for you. And where this comes from is there was a study done, I think, in the mid 80s in Crete, which is an island in the Mediterranean. And that was the origin of the idea of the Mediterranean diet. And people saw that people were fairly healthy. And the study, by the way, was funded by an olive oil or a set of olive oil companies.
Surprise.
And so the thesis was that have olive oil, it's good for you. So very quickly after that, more studies were done. And what they did is they said, well, there's other things. These guys are active. And in a lot of, you know, the United States, people are, you know, desk jockeys. They're typing a lot and they're not, you know, moving around. And could exercise have something to do with it? And so they did another study, a number of studies, where they looked at the same diet sans, without the olive oil, and the results were much better. And so the net of it is, if you think about it, if you subscribe to what we suggest, 10% fat calories, or if you subscribe to what somebody else talks about, 12, 15%, there is a limit to fat. And what I tell my students is olive oil is squished olives. Olives are good for you. They have some good nutrients. They have fiber. When you squish the olives, you leave all the fiber behind. You have pure liquid fat. And so, first of all, if you take one of my classes or any Food for Life instructor's classes, we will show you how to cook without any oil, zilch, zero, nada, no oil. We'll show you how to do it. And we'll show you how to acclimate to that, to those tastes. And it's not absolutely zero, because on cast iron, what I do is I put a few drops, I turn the cast iron on, and then I wipe off the oil just to create a little surface. So it's a trivial amount of oil. I do buy oil, but a bottle of oil for me lasts a year and a half or something like that, because I use such a small amount. So the studies showed that without olive oil, you did even better. So my thesis is this: if you agree, even if you don't agree with us, 10%, you subscribe to 12 or 15, there's a certain amount of fat that you really should stop at. Do you like chocolate? I do. I like chocolate. And would I rather eat chocolate or olive oil? There's no question. I'd rather have the chocolate. And so I think that's a better choice. And I think that if you want to enjoy olives, I always have olives at home. I love olives. Olives are great. They're a good treat. And some chopped olives in a salad is nice.
Fabulous.
So don't cook with the oil, but use the olives. It's pure fat. You don't want that in your system.
Very good. And where are the Food for Life instructors on salt?
So we don't take an official position on sodium, but what we do say is that, you know, if your healthcare provider says not to take added salt, then, you know, you should follow what your healthcare provider says, because it can increase blood pressure. If you're eating a good, healthy, low-fat, plant-based, limited-fat, whole food plant-based diet, then it's going to do a lot to mitigate your blood pressure anyhow. So just a little bit of anecdotal evidence. For years before I was married, I went without adding salt to anything. But then later on, I started adding some salt, and I find a little bit of salt at the table or when you're cooking brings out other flavors. And so what I would say is, if your health, follow what your healthcare provider says, but the problem isn't salt at the table or when you cook, it's processed foods. If you look at canned foods or prepared foods, they're loaded with sodium. You know, if you buy a can of soup, you know, I think we'll be talking about so many cooks in the kitchen and so many kids in the kitchen in a little while. So my daughter is a kid in the kitchen, and she demonstrated how to make soup. Homemade soup, if you have a pressure cooker, it's so easy. You chop some vegetables. If you have some broth, you put it in some vegan broth, you put it in. If you don't, maybe put some celery stalk in there or not. Put some water in, put some spices, some other flavoring particles, and cook it. And if you want to add a little bit of salt, I do add a little bit of salt to my soup. And the milligrams of sodium you're getting are very small compared to what's in canned soup. And the soup tastes so much better.
Yeah.
No olive oil or any of that. Just vegetables,
just good food, good quality stuff. Food, yeah. Herbs, spices.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't salt my food. And I find that when I go to restaurants,
oversalted.
Oh, everything. And we've been traveling a little bit, and we went to the Stanford Inn for Memorial Day weekend, if you're familiar with that.
I've heard of it. It's pretty famous.
Yeah, it's an all vegan resort in Mendocino.
Oh, and I didn't know that.
Yeah, all vegan. And wow. The owners are quite passionate about it. And they teach courses up there too. And
nice.
They do a beautiful, it's just beautiful. So they've reopened recently, thanks to COVID. They closed for a while. And so we were eating their sumptuous breakfast every morning. And it had more salt than I was used to. And I just feel that salt all the time on my tongue. And I can't wait to just, okay, I'm ready now to get back. It's and part of it is what you're used to, but it's good that a little bit of salt, I think a little bit of salt is okay. If you're just adding it and you're not having the processed foods and you're not using it in everything you cook.
Yeah, take guidance from your healthcare providers. You know, in my family, one thing which nudges me up on the salt a little bit is my wife, because she's hypothyroid. She needs to add extra salt. She needs to, you know, have a more salty diet for her thyroid health. And so she adds whatever I serve for her is not salty enough. So she does add salt. And so there are people for whom that's important. One thing, Karen, I'll say that I should have thought of this earlier, and it only occurred to me a few months ago, and I knew this, is, you know, there's this trend to use all these designer salts.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And I like to tell my students about it because they taste very different, whether you're using a kalanamic or you're using a pink salt or a black salt, black lava salt, or maybe alder smoked salt. San Francisco, there's a good source of that. There's all these nice salts that in my last Swimming Cooks show, I talked about Fleur de Sel. There are all these wonderful salts. But the thing that I had forgotten and I've come back to is it is important if you are regulating your salt to be sure you have a source of iodine. Iodine is essential. And a lot of these designer salts, which I'm calling designer, do not have iodine. Mm. And so if you're salting your food, make sure you're also using good old fashioned iodized salt.
Right. I take Dr. Furman's supplement.
Good.
A multi, which has iodine in it.
Good.
And occasionally I'll have a little sea vegetable.
Seaweeds. Yeah. Right, yes. Sea vegetables. I don't, my palate doesn't like sea vegetables, but from a nutrition point of view, they're great choices. Yeah. I wish I liked them. To me, they remind me of what fish would smell like. And it just, it's a distasteful thing to me. yeah. My daughter loves sushi and I don't.
Okay.
Do you want my theory on palate changes?
Yeah.
So it's funny because, you know, you think about from a, if you're religious from a God point of view, if you're philosophical from a, you know, how are we're created point of view, but why is it that humans have different palates? My daughter does not like asparagus. She will not eat asparagus, right? I love asparagus, right? And I have a theory about that. I think that Mother Nature and our genetic makeup has designed us so that, you know, for example, I think people understand kale is really good for you. It's one of the most nutrient-dense foods. Whole Foods Market labels it as, I think, 1,000 on a scale of 1,000 on their ANDI score, aggregate nutrient density index score. And so I know there's probably people out there who don't like kale. And my theory is that Mother Nature has rolled the dice in our genetic makeup so that a certain number of people for any food like kale say no thanks. And the reason is, what if there's something that we don't know that has long-term effect that kale actually is bad for? Mm. And we discover this down the road and all of a sudden everybody who's been eating kale goes kerplunk and they die, right? But then people, or asparagus, right? So my daughter will stick around because she didn't indulge in asparagus.
Wow.
That's okay. My theory is maybe down the road we'll find out that some of these foods, you know, have side effects or complementary effects, you know, eaten with other things, with environmental, you know, things that are in the environment which cause, you know, maladies. And so that's the reason, is to protect us and to make sure we live on.
Okay. Interesting. Let's move on. Okay.
You don't like my crazy theories.
I don't know. I don't know anything. I don't know why we're here. I don't know what we're supposed to be doing. I just want to help reduce pain and suffering. I'm here to make vegans. And that's all I have to say about that. I reached out again to get you on this program because I wanted to talk about your
thanks for doing that.
Food shows. I saw your So Many Kids in the Kitchen. I thought it was adorable. I wanted to know more about it. And then you told me it had started with So Many Cooks in the Kitchen. So tell me about it.
So the pandemic's been really bad for so many people, and my heart goes out to people. It's been so traumatic. So many, we've lost so many people. even those who haven't had health effects, you know, we homeschool. I've been homeschooling since my daughter was in first grade, and she's, you know, we're rushing to finish up sixth grade. I have a lot I still have to get done with her before we call it a year.
Wow.
So we have less than two and a half weeks, and I'm kind of nervous how we'll get through it all. But anyhow, so we're blessed, we're lucky, we're very fortunate, we're very privileged that the pandemic really hasn't affected us. If anything, we have more school, and I've actually been teaching more. A lot of my classes have gone online. I've taught some virtual classes, you know, for people who aren't in the area. So it's been a good thing for me, and I realize I'm just really privileged, and my heart does go out to other people. So when the pandemic was really kicking in, you know, our classes, I was in the middle of a Food for Life class, and so we transitioned it to virtual, and I was one of the first to do it. So headquarters asked if I would actually do some training, and I put together some slides, and we had a very nice session where I said to the other instructors, you know, here's what I'm doing, and I shared some of what I was doing. Others were also coming aboard with online, but I shared, you know, a little bit that I had learned from the experience. And so I reached out to the instructors because, Karen, this is one community, Food for Life instructors, that I just love. If there's a Food for Life instructor in, you know, Seattle that I've never met, and I have a friend in Seattle, I can unconditionally recommend them because our headquarters does such a great job hiring us. Not hiring, we don't work for PCRM. We're independent, I guess, contractors. We charge as much, as little as we want. We do our own thing. Just we, you know, follow the guidelines of the classes and of a physician's committee. But I can unconditionally recommend any Food for Life instructor because I know that we all know so much about nutrition. We know so much about food, and we are, you know, picked from a wide field. And so I reached out and I said, you know, there's so many of us. There's about 300 of us instructors. Wouldn't it be nice if we could work kitchen to kitchen and kind of teach classes? And so I suggested having a meeting. So we had a virtual meeting, and very quickly. So Karen, I don't know if you remember this about me because we used to work together. I come up with lots of ideas. Many of them are terrible ideas. I'm not the best at implementing ideas, but I'm good at coming up with, I always have all sorts of ideas. I'm an idea person. And so we had this meeting, and the people on the meeting were can-do people. And we were saying, well, you know, we could kind of do something kitchen to kitchen, maybe do it every month, start one time, see how it goes. And even while we were talking, we came up with a name. Somebody said, too many cooks in the kitchen. And then we said, that's a bad name. How about so many cooks in the kitchen? And within minutes, one of the persons in the team had nabbed the name, somanycooks.com, and created a Facebook page. All this happened in that meeting. It was unbelievable. Wow. The people I work with are phenomenal. And we said, we'll do it. And so the first few, I was super nervous because I was dealing with the technology. I like to think I'm a good teacher. I've done a lot of teaching. I love my Food for Life classes. I love my math classes, my photography classes. I'm not nervous about teaching. I love it. You know, I like being out there. I like working with my students. But the first few, if you watch our first few, I don't think I did a great show because I was wondering, is the technology running? Are we, you know, glitching, and what's happening? And is, you know, the next person ready? And now I think we're much better at it, all of us, but especially I think everybody else did a really good job from the get-go. I probably didn't. And then, so what we do is I start the show and I say, welcome to our next show. Our last show was a few weeks ago. It was our anniversary. It was 1 year. And our next show is this Saturday. And this one, it's so many summer soups and salads. I'm making a watermelon gazpacho, which is wonderful. And so what we do is we all put together a recipe document. Last month, our recipe document was 44 pages.
A cookbook.
Karen, you need to find me a publisher because I want to write a book. I think for so many cooks in the kitchen every month. And Brenda Davis, my friend, who's an amazing registered dietitian, nutritionist, she's written all these books. She always is generous enough to contribute an appendix. So she writes a substantial appendix to each one of these shows.
Wow.
And so what we do is people follow along and they have our guides, you know, dozens and dozens of pages. Okay, so who's the next cook? It's John Doe. Okay, here's John Doe. This is what he's making. And here's a little background of who he is. And here's his recipe book. Okay, he's done now. The next cook is, it's Jane Doe. So here's something about Jane Doe and so forth. And so so I start and we have about 9-10 minutes each. It's a soft rule. We often go over. And so I'll say, welcome. this week we're doing such and such, and maybe give some context, maybe talk about some upcoming events. And then you're in my kitchen. So I'll say, okay, so this is what we're doing. This is how I chop things. Take a look at this. And then this is what we're doing. And it's all in the recipe document. And voila, here's the dish. So next I'm delighted to pass on to my friend in California. And, you know, Sherry is going to be making, you know, crepe Suzette, and it's all vegan, whole food, plant-based and healthy. Take it away, Sherry. Wow. And then she does. And then we go kitchen to kitchen. And we usually have a dozen, sometimes as many as 18 or 19 cooks. And wow, our shows run long, Karen, they run long, but I don't mind, because some people will say, I'm not going to stick around for, you know, two and a half, 3 hours. And that's cool, because we record this. And then, have you heard of Plant-Based Network?
Yeah.
So Plant-Based Network, Ron Gendiza and his team have picked up our show, and they picked it up last year. And so they will take an edited version, and then it's there, and you can watch it on a phone, on Roku. You can watch it on Apple TV. You can watch it on the web. And so we now, you know, our shows, usually we get roughly 100 people who watch it live, but within a day, we're up to 1,000. And within a few days, we're up to sometimes 10,000 or more.
Wow.
So we get a lot of people watching our shows. And then Plant-Based Network itself draws thousands and thousands and thousands of people.
That's
so
great.
Our deal is to get the word out. We're trying to get the word out. We do all this for free. We're not making any money. We don't want to make money doing this. And so that's what So Many Cooks in the Kitchen is. I'm proud to be a part of it. And, you know, I'm excited for, you know, our next show. And then we have the next few shows scheduled. So in July, late July, we're doing So Many Picnic Foods. We're talking about August. We haven't set the theme yet. And we're also talking about September. So we're trying to figure out the dates and what we'll make. And we have a long spreadsheet of topics. We have, like, seems like no end of topics. For example, air fryers, or, you know, different appliances, pressure cooking, maybe a show just on tempeh, a show just on, we've already done a show on tofu, maybe a show on ethnic foods. So all of us, if we're American, we have some ethnicity that we go back to. So in my case, I could talk about Indian foods, for example. There's been some interest in having maybe a special show just on Latinx foods, or maybe foods that appeal to soul foods and African Americans, something of that nature. So, you know, we have tons of ideas to explore. And so then you were asking about kids in the kitchen.
Yeah.
So three of us have children who like presenting. So my friend Cody Stubbe in Nebraska, and then my friend Ella Rodriguez in Providence, Rhode Island, and myself, we have children ranging in age from 4 to 12. And so we don't want to get them on too often. So every other month they're on, and they do an amazing job. I have to tell you, Karen, that my fault, and when I look at my videos, I talk too fast and I'm doing all this kind of stuff. Slow down, be calm, take your time. And that's what my daughter Anu does. Welcome, everybody. Today I'm going to be making a smoothie. You know, smoothies are really good. And my dad tells me not to drink them too fast because your blood sugar goes up too fast. That's the way to do it. And I learned from her.
Oh, I love that.
It's great. And so because of her, I think I've become better. And so the kids are in the kitchen. They're in the kitchen. You don't see any adults. And at the end, we do Q&A. And then you see their parents, because each of them has a Food for Life instructor, parent, a cook in the kitchen, and the kids in the kitchen. And we take questions. And it's really, really fun. We help answering questions. So what we do is they're in the kitchen every other month. We started off last summer, and we did in quick succession three shows within a few weeks. It was our summer camp. I think it was within 10 days or so we did three shows. But then since then, we've been doing it every other month. And then we have special guests. So we've had Brenda Davis and Reshma Shah, who wrote a book recently on
Nourish.
Reshma is a pediatrician. So yeah, we had them on Nourish. And the kids asked them some questions. We asked them some questions. They gave their presentations. We had Genesis Butler, who's an animal advocate. She's not much older than the kids in the kitchen. She's 14, as I recall, and she's in California. Wow. Mm-hmm. So she talked about what she's been doing. And in the future, we'll probably have some more special guests as well. So that's what Kids in the Kitchen is about. And they also get a cookbook. But the difference, Karen, with them, with us, we publish our cookbook, our recipes, just a few minutes before the show. And I can't answer why. I've asked the other cooks, should we do it earlier? And they say no. So that's fine. We do it just before the show. But the Kids in the Kitchen, we release their document a few days before the show. And it might surprise you, but a lot of families cook along with us.
Oh, that's
and they buy
nice.
The ingredients. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so when our little kids are cooking, so are their kids, which
oh,
is
that's
really
great.
Nice. Yeah. And we get people from around the world who watch and watch our shows.
That's fantastic.
It's fantastic.
Me and my partner, Gary, we've done some food shows with people cooking with us and during COVID. It's really a phenomenal experience. It really is. Everybody, and especially when you can't be together, and it's different than just chatting on Zoom. When you're actually doing something together and you're all making something together, it makes you feel closer somehow.
You know, it does make you feel closer, because I have to say that, you know, the cooks in the kitchen, I feel such a strong bond to them. And I know some of them, you know, my friend Carolyn Strickland in Alabama, we've known each other for years. But most of them I've never met, but some of them I consider to be very close friends. My friend Cody is like one of my very best friends. And I think, and she says the same thing about me. We've never once met. You know, we both have kids in the kitchen and we do a lot of planning for the shows together, and we're very close.
And, okay, you've probably had this idea already, but when we're free and clear of COVID scares,
we are going to meet. And
you're
going to
have
some
kind of food in the kitchen. Food. You need to have a retreat or some
gathering. It's in the works. So my friend Mark, I never met him. He's awesome. We've become very good friends. And our last show, he grilled. I don't know anything about grilling. So he grilled and he was in his backyard. It was an amazing backyard. And I said, we should really all meet maybe there. So we've been talking about, once the pandemic's over, maybe having two or three locations, maybe an East Coast location, a Midwest location, and a West Coast location. And then our foreign presenters as well, people from other countries. And so maybe we'll do a Cooks in the Kitchen show with a dozen or 14 of us or whatever from three or four locations. So yeah, we'd love to do that.
I love it. So what platform do you use when you're doing recordings?
It's a great question. We started off with Zoom, and I put together this very detailed script that we follow to get this going. And Zoom is not designed for this, to be honest. It's not designed for many together, you know, broadcasting. And so we recently switched about 3 months ago or 4 months ago to StreamYard. And I like StreamYard a lot, because what StreamYard lets us do is it lets us have, unfortunately, it's limited to 12. So we have to switch people in and out. But there's a group of people who are called guests. And then we simulcast to as many platforms as we want. So now we have a YouTube presence, a Twitter presence, and of course, Facebook, which we always have had. And it's all at the same time. It doesn't cost us any performance. And people, because we used to get people who said, we'd like to see your show, but we're not on Facebook. Well, now you can watch it on YouTube if you want, or on Twitter.
Wow.
And so it goes at the same time. And the other cool thing about StreamYard is it allows us to integrate video, pre-recorded video. So now I work with a video editor. This one that we're working with now is in England, and she puts together intros and outros. So we have a song. So Carolyn Strickland, I mentioned earlier, she's actually she's a longtime Food for Life instructor, as I am. She's also a professional singer, a musician. And so she recorded our theme song. It's very catchy. So many cooks in the kitchen. So many cooks in the kitchen. So many foods to enjoy. And it's a jingle. People get it in their heads and kind of hum it. And so she recorded it. She works with a professor of music who has recorded jazz with, was it Wynton Marsalis or one of Wynton Marsalis's brothers, right? So he's a serious musician. So he's done the music and she's done the singing. And so now we have our shows. When we start, we have a countdown timer. And we have all these cool video effects where food coming in and out, some of the pictures of us. With the kids, we do really cute ones. I don't know if you've seen any of them, but we started doing this one saying, are you ready? So we start counting down at 25, 24, 23. Yeah. Then one of the kids shows up, are you ready? And then, you know, they have their hat on and they have some food. And then, you know, we keep counting down. Then another kid shows up, almost. And then they keep counting down. And then there's a really cute four-year-old and she says, I'm not ready. Just kidding. And then we count down to zero and then we show some video of the kids doing things and then boom, we're in the first kid's kitchen. It's great. And then at the end we wave bye and then we show the outro video. So it's really, it looks professional and nice. And it's so fun.
And fun. Yeah. Technology. We have come a long way. Yeah. Dilip, I have so enjoyed chatting with you and I hope we can do that sometime in person again, like in the old days. but until
I'm
then,
always here. I'm always here.
You're always there. Okay.
Can I leave with a message?
Absolutely.
If you are listening and you are vegan, see if there's any place in your diet to improve, to go more whole food plant-based so that you're eating healthier, because the world looks at you and they may say, yes, you are maybe an ethical vegan, but I don't want to look like you because you're overweight, you're not healthy, you get sick. So it's easy to be healthy. So if you're vegan, try to become whole food plant-based. If you're listening to this, this podcast and you're not vegan, know that it's easy to be vegan. There's so many resources. There's thousands. And just on my blog, so Karen, I'm going to quickly brag. I've known my wife 16 years, I think. 16 or 17 years. Never repeated dinner for her.
I wanted to ask you about
all
that.
Whole food,
how
plant-based.
Do you do that?
Well, it's all vegan. It's mostly whole food plant-based. And it's fun. It's a fun challenge. If I can do it, you can do it. So if you're not vegan, know that there's tons of health benefits. Look at PCRM, look at Michael Greger, nutritionfacts.org. So many good resources to help you, recipes, so many cooks in the kitchen. Check out our shows. So if you're not vegan, try to increase the amounts of plant foods you're eating. You'll feel better. Do some research about the environment. You will be doing the single most important thing you can do for the environment. And animals don't have to die for your diet. So consider that as well. So I hope that those are things that all of us, wherever we are on our journey, can take away from the wonderful work you do, Karen. I'm a small part today, maybe contributing a few gems of thoughts here and there, but what you know, the kinds of guests Karen has and her own wisdom will get you far, whether you're a vegan or not.
Oh, thank you. I'm giving you a big hug.
Likewise.
Philip Armin, thank you so much.
Karen Hartclass, thank you.
For giving me this time.
Oh, I appreciate it. I'm humbled you would ask me. That's very kind of you. Thank you.
Well, I'm finally glad we made it after 12 years.
Don't let another 12 years go by.
Exactly. No, we need to talk some more. Okay.
Anytime.
Thank you so much for joining
me. Thanks, Karen. Thank you.
And take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye. That was Philip Armin, everybody. I hope you enjoyed that interview. I'm so glad I finally got him back on the program after 12 years. Gary DiMattei, you've been hanging out with me while I've been doing this. How are you doing?
I haven't talked with you in a long time,
such
Karen.
A long time.
I know.
Doesn't everybody miss Gary's voice?
Yeah. Hi, everybody. I hope you're doing well.
Yes.
Karen, how are you doing? You've got a lot to promote, so let's get to it.
Okay. I want to invite people to responsibleeatingandliving.com. That's where Gary and I live.
Yes, we live there on that
site. Right there on that page. And right now, the Food Freedom webinar series is coming back. And
that's Dr. Susan Pierce Thompson.
Yes, you're right. That's Dr. Susan Pierce Thompson.
She's
now,
amazing.
She has, I think, the best weight loss program out there for people who are addicted.
Addicted to food.
To food, to sugar,
and
to
they do that
foods.
To you, don't they? They do that to you.
Yes.
They make you addicted to food.
This weight loss program is not for everyone.
No.
It is for people that have a serious addiction to food. And you can find out if you are one of those people by taking her simple quiz. I promote this program because I believe for those that really struggle with weight, that she has come up with a formula that works. It's rigid. And for most people, I don't encourage this rigidity because it requires specific quantities of food and weighing your food. But for those people who have failed over and over and over and over, this may be a solution.
Yes.
Because she's helped so many people. So go to responsibleeatingandliving.com. We have the Food Freedom series on our homepage. Check it out. Take the quiz. And then there are some subsequent webinars which will be released throughout the next couple of weeks that you can watch. They may inspire you.
Yes. And when you're at responsibleeatingandliving.com, don't forget, Karen and I live there, so say hello.
Say hello at info@realmeals.org. I also want to mention again, if you have not read The Unnatural Order, if you haven't ordered the book, this is your assignment. We all need to read this book. We all need to talk about it. That was my program a couple of weeks ago. I re-aired it last week by Jim Mason. I was so moved by this book. Read it. Tell me that you're moved. Then if you weren't moved, tell me why. I think it can really help the planet more than any other. And that's just my opinion.
Or you can just simply go vegan.
That's the easy way
to do
it.
If you don't like to read, if you just like to lay out in the sun, then just go vegan.
Gary, you just put it simply.
That's right.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for joining me. Gary, thanks for tuning
in. Yeah, I'd like to pop in and say hello to all of
my popping in.
Friends at Responsible Eating and Living. Now I'm going to go back to my page.
Okay, everybody.
Have a delicious week. Thank you.